Welcome to 501c3 BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth. I'm your host, Zoot Velasco.
We just need one big fundraiser.
Our clients are our donors.
Bigger is better.
Who cares what the mission statement is?
I work in nonprofits.
Bullshit!
We have completed 8 episodes of 501c3 BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth, with 8 interviews of luminaries in our field. I hope you've enjoyed them, shared them, and found their work valuable. It's my gift to the sector for all it has given me. Today, I want to circle back and listen to some of the BS shared by our esteemed guests. They each hit on very interesting topics with great insight. And who doesn't like to complain a bit about certain aspects of our industry? Our first podcast was on the word nonprofits, where we talked to Hilde Gottlieb, founder of Creating the Future, and the person who coined the term community benefit organization. When I asked Hilde her 501c3 BS, she pointed to all the excuses made by organizations in our sector who stay small by believing the myth that there is a lack of resources.
The key piece in my mind is the self-defeating notion that change is hard, that we can only make incremental change, that cultural change is difficult, that therefore we can only do what we can do with the limited dollars that we have. And there is so much bullshit in all of that, but it is it really comes down to our beliefs. We believe that money is scarce. Money is, resources are not scarce. Money is scarce. Resources are abundant. There's people everywhere. There's cars. There's empty buildings. There's resource everywhere.
Exactly.
But we believe that we need money, and we have been told that over and over again, that it is all about the money. Again, the name reinforces that. So when we see ourselves as resource poor, when in fact we are resource rich and maybe money poor, that leads to cycles of, well, we can only do what we can do because we don't have enough, and you get on that hamster wheel. And what winds up happening is our belief about scarcity guides our belief about what we can accomplish. But we also have seen organizations that have created sweeping change, and they are usually not the large organizations that have 20% of the wealth, if in fact that number is correct. I believe you. The large organizations tend to be more focused on self-perpetuation and less focused on actually solving and especially creating, forget solving the problem, but creating what is possible. And the easiest example for the fact that cultural change can happen swiftly, and doesn't require something the size of a Gates Foundation to do, is Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And Mothers Against Drunk Driving in 10, 20 years changed the entire culture of not only this country, the U.S., but changed the culture in many countries. From when I was growing up and a kid, it was, just get home safe, honey, to my daughter, it's, I'm not drinking, I'm DD tonight. Well, there was no DD when I was growing up. And that changed swiftly, and it changed seemingly overnight, and it changed an entire culture of the country. You look back to the early days of The Tonight Show with Dean Martin and Johnny Carson smoking on set and sweeting scotch, we'd be appalled right now. And so the biggest myth is that we can only accomplish a little bit because, myth number two, we only have a little bit of money. And no matter how large the organization is, they will tell you, we could do more if we had more. And the answer is no, actually, you could do more if you asked a completely different set of questions and saw resources differently.
Asking different questions is what Hilde is now dedicated to doing with her organization, Creating the Future. This excuse of a lack of resources was also on the brain of Jeffrey Wilcox of the Third Sector Company, who we interviewed about boards. Jeffrey had a slightly different take on this.
I am tired of the bullshit of what I will call the scarcity mentality, as opposed to the abundance mentality. And what really ticks me off is groups of people who want to do something and feel victimized because their glass is constantly half full. And I'm sorry, half empty. Let me be clear on this. I mean, they're always acting from the glasses half empty. And we know in society at a time when women couldn't vote, when gay and lesbians couldn't marry, that when we wanted to see something happen as a society, we started with the glasses always half full and tried to recognize what limited assets we have, we are going to use those to the fullest to make something happen. And I have just sat around so much of my career and watched people talk about what we don't have and whining about it, as opposed to looking at the great organizations that occurred in this country where people who said, we don't have much, but what we've got, we're going to use it to the fullest. And those are the organizations that are thriving because they appreciated what they had, as opposed to getting together and mourning about what they don't.
Jeffrey went back to elaborate on the importance of not thinking in terms of fundraising, but getting back to the primary thought processes of working to accomplish the mission, not funding organizations.
In your introduction, you know that I've sat on boards and led local chapters of the Association of Fundraising Professionals throughout my career. And one of the things that bothers me significantly, and I'm going to put this in the BS department if given the chance here, is another piece of BS, is that fundraising is not financing. And we have moved as a sector to look at the science of human generosity. I'm sorry, the art of human generosity is the science of organizational financing. And the problem is that the amount of assets that it takes for a social benefit organization to actually create social benefit lies in other assets in addition to money. The fundraising industry is moving into a financing industry, and I'm very upset about that. If we can create a new generation, and I am very excited by what I'm seeing in the new generation, if we can create a new generation who is basically saying, we have a sector here that hasn't moved the needle to our liking, we're going to do it a different way, I find that pretty exciting. There is an entrepreneurial infusion that's occurring in the third sector that keeps this old man invigorated and feeling very youthful.
Every day I see organizations who have great anxiety about fundraising. They will say, finding other resources is all well and good, but you can't make payroll on other resources. And I will spend so much time looking for them that I don't focus on the money I need coming in to balance the checkbook. But these people are missing the whole point. If they were not out looking for money, but instead were out looking for community collaboration to serve their mission, they would find it all. Recently, I was talking to a client, a new CEO of a small organization in a small town. We were in a restaurant near her work to get out of the office and talk without other people around, eavesdropping. It was a restaurant she had not been to before, and I hadn't been there either. It smelled amazing when we walked in, and the food was great. The owner eventually came by and introduced himself. I praised his great restaurant. Then I introduced my colleague and bragged about her great organization just down the road. He commented on how the mission was important to him because of his background as a child. It was in a perfect opening, and I waited for my client to pick up the ball. But she never did, and he walked away. Some may say, well, why say anything at all? You aren't going to ask him for money the second you meet him. But he is a new restaurateur in the community who expressed interest in the mission. It's not about doing a fundraising campaign or targeting for a letter or invite for a gala. It's about a community in which you evangelize your mission. You form relationships. What if you started going to the restaurant more often? Just because the food is good. And what if you invite the owner to take a tour of the facility and programs that you run? And after months of hanging out, he offers to donate food for your programs or events, gives funding, or offers to be on the board. And what if you were not just doing it here at this restaurant, but everywhere you go in town? People like your can-do spirit, your sense of community, and your ability to get things done. They feel your friendliness is genuine. Not that they are just a target for funding. Soon, you are a phone call away from anything you need in town. We need warming pans for a breakfast next month, your staff say. You make a call. You get not just the warming pans, but the breakfast donated so you don't have to buy it. We need a 15-passenger van to take the kids on a field trip. You make a call. It's donated by a rental car company. The owner is in your chamber or rotary and loves how plugged in you are to everything. How would you like to keep this van, he says. It's used and I can write it off. This is the life of a CEO who works by community connection to the mission, and not by crying about scarcity of resources or looking for targets for funding. I was one of these CEOs. A day didn't go by where someone wouldn't say to me, it's amazing what you're doing with that organization. It was nothing before you came. And it's nice to hear. It isn't true, but it's nice to hear. But what they are really saying is, we appreciate your attitude of community building. Next up, some great pearls of wisdom from the largest funder in Orange County, California, my friends Todd Hansen and Shelley Haas at the Orange County Community Foundation. Wouldn't you love to be in a room and hear what funders talk shit about? Well, here's your chance. I asked Todd what piece of BS drives him crazy, and this is what he said.
One is nonprofits that talk poorly about other organizations. Mm. We're the only one that does it. We have the best model there is, That's baloney. And they'll sit across from me and say, yeah, we're the only one doing this, when I know I've met three other ones doing the same work and two of them doing it better. So that kind of bravado is baloney. You know, just be honest about what you do and who you are without having to put down others.
Shelley chimed in with a great observance about phony collaboration.
One of the things that to me is the most annoying BS is when collaboration isn't really collaboration, it's collusion to fake out funders who they think are too dumb to see through it. And this is the advantage that Todd and I have from having come into, we both came to these roles only from having served in grant-seeking, direct service-providing community-based organizations. Is that your preferred terminology, Zoom? A community benefit organization? So, like, we knew the BS from the inside, and so to me, if you're going to call it a collaboration, it has to really bear the marks of true collaboration, that you've really thought about each other's objectives and valued them equally with your own and done something. True collaboration in its purest form should happen with or without outside funding. Right? A lot of the collaborations we've talked about didn't take anybody funding it. It's real collaboration. You find a way to do it, and then you go to funders and you go, look what we just did, and we think we can do even more. But to call something a collaboration that really is just, you know, dividing up the pie on the back end and saying, okay, we're going to go in with a collaborative proposal, but really what we're doing is everything we would have just done independently, but we're just mashing it up, then I call it collusion and that's BS.
This is why community benefit organizations who are actually focused on the community and their mission, doing real collaboration, find resources with and without funding. That gets noticed, and funders want to go back to these organizations. These are the winners who will make change happen without funding. So how much more successful will it be with it? That is an organization in which people want to invest. Funders can see the phony people. Here's another example of this from Francis Phillips, who literally wrote the book on the sector, The Nonprofit Kit for Dummies. Francis calls BS on the phony words people use.
Oh, boy. You know, you prepared me for this question a little bit, and I think that actually it was that language that I just introduced, that where the words have been used so often that they don't, that they've lost their meaning. That's probably what I would call bullshit on. I've just, you know, I've just recently been at meetings where the word community, I lost count of how often it was used and never specified what it meant. I just believe in going back and using plain language. And I believe in, you know, that's, I think that's where, when we come back around to the main topic we've had here today about, you know, why are mission statements important? They're important if they provide clear guidance to your organization and a clear message for you to share with constituents. And if they're composed of buzzwords that gets in the way of their being very clear, they're going to, you're going to trip over them when you seek guidance, and your constituents won't really understand what you're trying to communicate. That's a shame.
So let's review what we have so far. Great organizations with great leadership don't cry about a lack of resources, but get things done with what they have. They are entrepreneurial, about making something out of nothing by creative partnerships in the community that are real and not dependent on dollars, but a real sharing of resources. They express themselves, not in buzzwords, but in plain English with clear definitions of who they are, what their mission is, and who they serve. And they would never pretend to be the best or put down others. They are proud of their strengths and successes, but cognizant of their weaknesses, opportunities to do better, and threats. Now that is an organization I want to help. Our friend Tar, from our episode on millennial marketing, will not be included in this podcast. His BS was about the fallacy of the big gala, about which we did an entire podcast, so he's covered. The last two guests called bullshit on the same thing, and it's a whopper. These two guests, who both make their living consulting with organizations, both called bullshit on planning. Cynthia Friedman of Community Partners came to the conclusion to scrap the traditional plan altogether and go to a new model based on the book Nonprofit Sustainability, Making Strategic Decisions for Financial Viability by Jean Bell, Jan Masaoka, and Steve Zimmerman. I'm working to get one of them for a future podcast on this subject. Keep your fingers crossed. Here's Cynthia.
Well, I will tell you that when people come to us and ask for consulting on developing a strategic plan, I kind of let slip that I don't really believe in strategic plans, because I've just seen so many, just to be like the real Martin Luther heretic, you know, theses on the door here. I think that, of course, planning, of course, strategy, of course, you have to think about what you're doing and see if it's having an effect and think about where you want to be and what you want to do next. And of course, you have to get input from, you know, people around you to know what your blind spots are. But I have seen so many situations, I've facilitated them myself, where, you know, we do, you know, some key informant interviews, and we do a SWOT analysis, that's the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats,
right.
And then we have a board retreat, and then, you know, everybody gets excited, oh, we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to go this way, and we're going to go that way, and then, oh, and then we'll just raise all the money that we need to, or we'll just get a development director who'll raise all the money that we need to do that. And I just find that so useless. So I think now when I'm working with boards or working with organizations about planning, it's more about what are five things that you can put on one sheet of paper in terms of action steps. And I really like, I don't know if you've come across the book, Nonprofit Sustainability. This is the Matrix Map Model book. This is by Jan Masaoka, Gene Bell, and Steve Zimmerman, who are some very bright people. Jan Masaoka now runs California nonprofits. Gene Bell runs a consulting firm up in the Bay Area that I'm forgetting the name of. That's fantastic. And what they do is kind of looking at everything you do. They have a whole method, which I now teach to groups, for looking at sort of the all your programs and all your fundraising activities, and you look at them on a grid that shows you their impact and how much they cost and their profitability. So you map everything out, and suddenly you can see on one page, oh, we have this river education program that has raises a huge amount of money because everyone wants to see the kids learn about the river, and it has quite a bit of impact on kids. And so that's in our successful quadrant. And meanwhile, we have a board that is totally focused on advocacy, for which we raise no money and for which we're having limited impact. So it's a way of kind of making your blind spots more visible and seeing where you have energy and where you have money and where you have impact and where you're and moving forward and strengthening those areas and seeing where you're having the intersection of low impact and high cost. And that's where you have to say stop, no matter how much we love this or no matter how much, you know, it's what we've always done. We have to stop doing this. It's not helping anyone and it's draining our organization of resources. So I use that more now. And just try to make it a little bit less about, oh, we'll have a 20-page plan and all our problems will be solved. So I'm kind of off strategic planning.
Meanwhile, our guest Kathy Mostovoy was frustrated with spinning wheels and money working on a plan for organizations that have no intention of using it.
I'm going to call bullshit on doing board of directors retreats when you have no intention of actually moving things from either the board end or the staff end.
Now, I think the flip side of that is if you're doing a retreat with a consultant or someone like us as a facilitator that's putting together a strategic plan where you really want the board and the staff to be involved in it and it to be their idea so that they're invested in it, I think that's a really good thing. But I agree with you when they have a retreat just to have a retreat and there's not any team building going on, there's not any planning going on, it's just a retreat to retreat. Maybe that's not a great idea.
Right. Well, and I think And when I'm looking at it saying that it is bullshit, is you come up with a day and a half, you have your board, you all come up with all these plans, and you go back to whomever's writing up that plan. And that's the end of the plan until next year at your next retreat.
Well, I think so. What you're really calling bullshit on, then, is not so much the retreat. It's the, and somebody else said this on another podcast from Community Partners, said that she hates the idea of strategic planning because it's all bullshit. People just pretend to do a plan, they throw it in a drawer, and that's it. I'm of the belief that a strategic plan can be the best thing you do if you actually implement it and review it quarterly and look at the goals monthly and have the staff look at the goals weekly and really, you know, use that plan as deadlines and goals for your organization. I think I agree with you when they put three big hairy goals up there and then just throw it in a drawer and never do anything.
Right, and I think that's what I'm calling bullshit. And what I will say to you, you're talking about continuous quality improvement. And that's a whole different conversation. If you're using your plan for continuous quality improvement in your organization, absolutely, that is the purpose of it. That is the reason you do it. But most organizations do it as a checkbox. And I personally, when I am going out and talking to clients, I tell them I don't want to do that. I mean, I'd rather not take their job and they can get somebody else. There's too many, you know, people that understand that. That's not what I do. I'm a big data person, evaluation person, and that goes along with your strategic planning. And that is just a revolving circle. It goes on and on. It's a continuous circle. So, yes, agreed. But bullshit on the funders usually telling people or boards, staff, that they need this strategic plan that goes in a drawer. Yeah.
Well, And you said the most important thing is that you have to do constant evaluation, which leads to planning, which leads to implementation, which leads to evaluation. And most people are not doing that. But that's not a failure necessarily of boards so much as directors. I think CEOs are the ones who are ultimately charged with implementing that plan.
Correct. They are. Most of your CEOs are the ones implementing that plan. And I don't think a lot of CEOs, I think they get so tied down into operation day-to-day management that they can lose sight of how to keep themselves sustainable, build capacity, all the, you know, your fund development plan, your marketing plan, all those wheels you have turning in the air at the same time. And I think the strategic plan, although it should be the first thing you're looking at to get direction, tends to be the last thing that you know, CEOs look at. And I don't know if that's just part of the job.
Well, good. You know, I think I'm going to have to do a podcast on strategic planning because it's come up now with several people I've interviewed. And I think it's not so much that strategic planning is bullshit. It's the way people are strategic planning
that
is bullshit.
Yes, I would agree with you. Yeah, you're right. The plan itself is not bullshit. But how many times have you done that with a group? And then you talk to them the next year and they're like, oh, we haven't touched that. It's like, what?
Yeah.
And then also, yeah, it's kind of like my time is in there, too, and my dedication. Like, what do you mean you didn't even look at it?
Yeah. Well, like I said, for me, that's a failure of leadership. And I just kind of, you know, because I spend a lot of time coaching the CEO when I do plans on how to implement it. And when I see that they threw it in a drawer and didn't do it, then, you know, and honestly, with me, it doesn't happen that often because I spend so much time kind of drilling into them what they need to do with the plan. But when it does happen, then I just see it as a failure of leadership.
No, I agree. I think it is. I think it's them. And I think it's just, for whatever reason, it's gone to the bottom of the pile. You know, I'm not going to put that on anyone, but it's gone to the bottom of the pile. Like I said, for me, personally, I'd rather not write it. I'd rather not get invested in this project if it's because you're checking a box.
I can say I've done plans with multiple organizations that doubled their funding because they followed the plan. So, you know, I would rather take the, when I'm going into planning, I'd rather take the tack that they're going to follow it than just assume they're not.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, well, I think that part of that is, as a consultant, part of that is as I've learned over the years now, and I think I've gotten a lot better, on me qualifying the questions for the reasons on why they're doing it. So I think I've learned to ask better questions so that the clients that I get are in a better position to actually implement it. And then that doesn't mean I throw them, you know, I don't say, no, I wouldn't do it. I'd say, you know, I go to them about, you know, have you thought about trying some of these things first before you go into a full-on planning development that you don't sound ready for at all? So, you know, I think it's just, there is some qualifiers as consultants that I think we can do. And education, you know, and I don't know if we're still on record, but the other one with strategic planning that you might want to talk about is, we were talking about consultants and educating on people in the social sector about how you hire and what you're looking for when you're hiring an outside consultant. So I think there's a lot of learning that needs to be taken on both ends and what expectations are. And truly, I'm sure you and I, if somebody said, hey, I'm really checking the box with this strategic plan, can you look over my last five proposals and put something together? You could do it for them in a second without doing all the work, without doing the due diligence. It's like, you have the stuff here, guys. It's here. I don't know. It's an interesting topic for you to look at because there's so many directions people are going with it.
Yeah, I think I'll do another podcast. Well,
yeah,
on that,
it's really an interesting because it's kind of changing now over the time to where it was so front and center for now it's why, but I still want it, so I still have to do it, but why am I doing it? What am I getting out of it? And I think you just spoke to that. It's actually the leadership. What are you getting out of it? It's, as we all know, it's what you put into it. So,
and I've seen a lot of bullshit plans too, where somebody spent, I don't know, $20,000-$30,000 on a consultant to do a plan, and then they end up with a 1 or 2 page plan that has just, you know, bullshit goals on it that have nothing to do with the organization, and it's no wonder it gets thrown in a drawer.
Right. Well, and I'm laughing because that just happened to me recently. It's like, oh, I'm sorry.
I've seen that over and over in my career, and you know, it's one of the things that made me think I could do consulting because I was like, I could do a better job than some of these yahoos that they're hiring for much higher money to do, you know. Anyway, I'm getting off track.
It is frustrating to see organizations invest in planning because they were told by a funder they needed to have a strategic plan. But what does that mean? As we've heard, it can mean a great deal of different things. Some believe plans should be a bare bones, one-page document with a few big goals just to get people in the right directions. I would call that a vision plan. And if you have a good board or CEO with some vision, you don't need it. I think most organizations know what their big goals are. The devil's in the details. For me, a plan should have strategies, hence the name strategic plan, based on actual evaluation. And that plan should be tied to budgets, deadlines for staff, and include all areas of operation, including staff, board, facilities, program and mission, resource development, and notice I didn't say fundraising as per our previous discussion about resources. Resource development, marketing, collaboration, and this would be strategic partnerships in the community to accomplish not just the mission, but community betterment, and that's often overlooked, and administrative support. And if you have such a document, you have a blueprint for growth. All you need to do as CEO is connect the strategies tied to budgets with deadlines for the staff to meet, objectives for the board to hit, and challenges for funders and other stakeholders. A true consensus plan involves everyone, is exciting, and creates energy. It worked for me, and I've done this with more than a dozen organizations that have grown rapidly due to the planning, preceded by evaluation, and followed by action, reporting, and more evaluation, and then updating the plan. Some people say that they are too busy to do all this planning and evaluating. But how do you know if your programs are effective without adequate evaluation? And how can you do anything beyond driving in circles without a map? Good planning and evaluation is seamless with good leadership. I'm sure there are other ways, and I'm anxious to read the book Cynthia Friedman mentioned. But one thing planning is not, it's not a piece of paper you put in a drawer. That's bullshit.
Thank you for taking the time with us on 501c3BS. Check out my Twitter feed at 501c3BS, my webpage at zootvelasco.com, and my book, The First 100 Days, on Amazon. The music is provided to us from our good friends at the traditional Brazilian choro group, Grupo Falso Baiano, and Amy Molinelli. Find them at grupofalsobaiano.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great day free from BS.